Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 26 of Across the Isle, your favourite podcast about the performing arts in Melbourne. It's good to have you back in the studio to discuss another month of being provoked, intrigued, and entertained. I'm Philip Teal, and I'm here as always with my auntie, Carla Donnelly.
Auntie? Auntie what?
Auntie Carla.
Hi. I hope you mean it more in an Indigenous sense.
Wonderful. It's just always perfect to be with you. And last night we had this amazing experience at Night Dance, the first show we're going to talk about tonight, when Carla said, it's been a while since we've seen each other. And I was like, has it? 7 days? 8 days? And she was like, up to 3 weeks. 21 days had passed. Exactly.
I'm watching you.
So good. Okay, let's get down to business. Today, as always, we'll be discussing two shows that we imposed on one another. Carla's pick was Night Dance at Arts House in North Melbourne, and I chose the new David Williamson play Credentials at La Mama. These are two very different productions, and I can't wait to debrief. So here we are in North Melbourne. Let's turn down the lights and put on our dancing shoes for Night Dance, 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 dance.
Well, as we were just talking about off mic, I think I got this mixed up or I looked at the wrong page of the play. Like, I want to go and see more things at Arts House, so that fits the brief. But this wasn't what I thought it was going to be. But anyway, it doesn't really matter because it was pretty amazing, mostly. But yeah, having said that, I do want to go see more things at Arts House. They do, I think they're pretty much one of the only places that do dance programming these days. And it's not really within, quote unquote, like our wheelhouse of narrative stuff that we want to talk about. But, you know, after having Wessa on the show, it's like obviously there's a lot going on out there that we don't know. But I want to really broaden the spectrum of things that we see. So hence we went to this. And we'll just give you a little bit of the blurb, which says Australian and Berlin-based choreographer and performer Melanie Lane coaxes us off the couch and into the club, a pulsating new work that investigates the physical experience of the nightclub and its seductive promise of transformation, primal temptation, and sublime release. So as our keen listeners would know, I don't read anything about plays generally before I go. I definitely don't read reviews. So everything is a bit mysterious to me, and that's how I like it. Particularly with dance, that can be problematic because I try to put a narrative into everything. And we can talk about the narrative that I thought was in this, or two different kinds of narratives, which would probably map. It doesn't really matter. It's everyone's interpretation, right? But, you know, the reason why we went and saw this was very quickly solidified because the staging was beautiful and really magical. It was all black with this black cloth on the floor, velvet or whatever, I don't know, kind of rippled. Like, I thought it was actually like the sea or water. And there's three performers, three primary dancers in the production, but there was also like quite a few guests that came along in a sort of cabaret type feel along the journey. So I just wanted to shout out straight away that all of these dancers are absolutely extraordinary. Their movement was so hypnotic and beautiful, and it just started out really slow and built to this sort of crescendo, obviously, as the night moved on. But I really felt like at the beginning that this was almost like human evolution. Like, they're writhing around on the floor, they're coming out of the water, we're turning into humans. Mm. And then, you know, all the excesses later on of what humans do. Oh, and then also I had this other interpretation of like, oh, this is just everything that happens at night. So things coming out, nocturnal creatures. I had this like real animal thing because they were doing like hand movements like crocodiles and birds. Yeah, it was a more of a David Attenborough kind of thing for me, halfway, and then it turned into this crazy rave that was this whole other experience altogether. Philip, what did you think?
I'm just loving your reading of this as a kind of anthropological look at what people are and what people mean in these strange spaces we inhabit when we're still awake. Too late for our species, you know,
yes.
when we move into, as the program describes it, the sultry underworld. And indeed, there was a voyeuristic quality to this production, as there is a voyeuristic quality to being on a dance floor, right? And it was a look at the dance floor as an experience and as a space that I think you could only do with dance. And not just because there is that direct correlation of dance happening on a dance floor, but just dance as a art form works better than theatre at doing this sort of holistic look at an environment with different people in it.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And I just had this breakthrough in my understanding. I'm very new to dance other than ballet as well. And it suddenly twigged for me that it's in dance that you can have simultaneous action much more believably and holistically than you can in theatre. You don't have to narrow your focus to the speaking person or the gesturing person.
Mm.
You can have long periods in which different people are working together or disparately, but simultaneously to build a sense of three-dimensional, immersive, environmental action.
Polyglot.
And while the three main dancers, one of whom is the choreographer Melanie Lane and the other two are Lillian Steiner and Gregory Lorenzutti, were dressed in a kind of uniform style way, later in the production, the costume suddenly moved into very over-the-top artistic creations that suddenly broke the look of the production from a kind of simple liturgical sort of sameness into a real individualized approach. So Benjamin Hancock first appears in full glitter, that moment of a gold person with a giant dancer style cap emerging in full heels was super memorable. And then I had already read the program before, so I knew that somebody from Men Exclusive was in it.
Was he the guy with the lights?
He was the guy with the lights and the body yoddy yoddy.
Yeah, okay. We'll talk about that part soon because I didn't enjoy
Sydney
Seaman. the rave onwards.
Yeah, but it's not about... Okay, yes, no, we will talk later. But yeah, my experience of this as, you know, look at a nightclub, think about what we do in that space and also remember, I mean, embarrassingly, really. I mean, there's this moment in the second part of the production where the dancing becomes kind of ridiculous and thumpy and very much like work, a kind of industrialized set of repeated actions. And I thought, it's pretty dumb, you know, like what people do at clubs is actually kind of stupid.
Well, no, like I feel like I interpreted it that differently. So it's like, on one hand, you've got, well, you know, I don't know why I experienced it as a passing of time as well, like from the beginning of the night to the end of the night, but perhaps that was what was intended.
It did crescendo.
But the thing is that like the beginning was all about like the sort of the plumage, the mating dance kind of thing of what we do. And then the end of it was like just, you know, sex addicts grinding away at a swingers party. You know what I mean? Like that was just like... It's like you just, the people who are left at 5 a.m. on still on ecstasy, and it's just movement from, because if they didn't do it, their head would explode, you know. So.
And there's this crooner. I love this Ryan Ritchie crooning performer, like a vocal performer who just sort of was on the edge of things looking on and singing.
It was very Lynchian, to be perfectly honest. Like that's a term that gets thrown around willy-nilly everywhere, but this was like... very Lynchian, because you had the, you know, what I would consider to be sort of more traditional conceptual dance at the beginning, that first half. And then, you know, they're all lying on the floor and then this like crooner in a white suit just walks out of the audience onto the stage and sings a little ditty. And then this guy in like a mirror ball fucking suit with a dunce cap comes on out after that. And then, you know, a Sydney stripper with like laser fingers comes out and does a bit of like RoboCop rave dancing.
Yes, he does.
And then, you know, one of the other girls comes out as a stripper and the other guy looks like a Francois Sagat kind of Minnie Mouse thing, and it all just kind of ends.
And in the program, it was revealing actually that they had guest performers but also guest coaches. And I looked up these coaches and they were, you know, exotic dancers and burlesque performers and club dancers. So these contemporary nerdy VCA type dancers had obviously collaborated in a way that was really interesting with dancers who are actually seen by wider audiences at hens nights and other type of events. And it was actually in that first part when we had
that's
mostly...
That's fascinating. That's actually very fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And to have some gestures held by these contemporary dancers, Steiner, Lorenzutti and Lane, that were just so poised and so sensual and all about the booty and the leg and the shoe, it was mesmerizing.
See, that's funny. Like, I got the kind of like club aspect, but that's probably more where it was intended of. And that's where I was getting the creatures of the night thing, you know. So these are people who dance at night for audiences, you know, in these spaces. Yeah, it's really funny. Sydney Seaman, hopefully I'm saying your name right, meant for Men Exclusive. That was just bizarre and so out of place for the context. So I just didn't really understand why that was in there. And he had these laser fingers and kind of like a Magic Mike kind of, you know, camo outfit. No, like, what is it? It's like bomb protection kind of outfit. Anyway. And then I was like, you suck, whatever. But then he was so sweet at the end. Like, he was like holding the gay guy's hand and like making sure the ladies go before him when they're walking off stage. You know, like, he was so sweet and gracious and just so, I just felt like such an ass.
Yeah.
But I don't know what, like, why? Why for the second half of this? I don't know. But I really enjoyed it in terms of like that first half. With, you know, it's right to me, it was almost like I'd interpreted the night as like before we were conscious humans, like we're animals transforming into, you know, being conscious humans
and improvising that, you know, experimenting with different ways of moving and seeing what they feel like. That really slow motion element that you mentioned feeds into this cinematic quality as well that you've described.
It was the lighting and the staging was stunning.
Mm.
And the way that it lit their bodies. And this is what I love about this and what I think you were talking about in terms of it being like a three-dimensional language. Seeing how they light these bodies and seeing that level of precision is so extraordinary to me. But can I just, as a side, shout out to the two assholes who were sitting next to us who just talked and laughed through the entire show. I wish I could have, like, shamed them on the spot. And then they, like, gave them a standing ovation at the end going, that was amazing. And I'm just like, what is wrong with you people? I'm getting so sick of audiences, especially coming off the back of Myth. But we'll talk about that later. But in terms of, like, fitting the brief of us seeing really different things and... obviously being exposed, quote unquote, to actors and performers that we wouldn't really get in our journeys about town. Apart from the rave part of it, I really, really loved this.
The audience was also extremely well-dressed, poised.
Yeah, beautiful.
Soft scarves.
So we're going to be going to Arts House a lot more because I feel like we're missing out on something that's really great there. So stay tuned.
Short little runs at Arts House, that's the thing. You've got to put it in your diary.
Also, tickets are cheap. They're $30.
Mm-hmm. It's a partnership with Melbourne City Council. So there's some subsidies going on and it's really worth supporting.
To be frank, like after, you know, a lot of the things that I've seen this year from the bigger places, I'd much rather be spending, you know, getting two tickets for the price of one at Arts House and just seeing things that are completely outside of my comfort zone.
Much cheaper than Men Exclusive.
Well, I'll take your word for that. On that. All right. Oh, I think it's intermission.
Woo! It's intermission.
Yay.
And I think we need some coffee.
some coffee.
If we're going to go and see a movie at 11 a.m.
There is no coffee at any of the theatres that is good.
No.
You get bloody pod coffee.
Yeah. I used to sort of associate the bad cinema coffee with the Astor Theatre and that made it okay. But now Palace has taken over and there's the machine. Not the same.
No.
The same.
Oh, well, we have to talk about... There has to be some kind of choc top grading scenario that comes out of me.
But why do people eat? Just do not eat.
At a film?
Do not eat.
Mate.
Don't eat.
Mate, calm down.
I really, really don't understand why the cinema is an environment in which you would eat. It's an environment in which you're going to be for 90 minutes watching a film. There's all of the other times and places to
90
eat.
Minutes, 2.2 hours.
Well, yeah, actually. It is myth that we're debriefing.
This is what we need. We need sustenance to keep us going. Oh,
God, it's so flamboyant. It's like, if I don't crackle, I don't exist. I need to glow and crackle.
Let's talk about myth then.
Okay.
How should we do it? Just tell me your top two film. No,
top
hang on. Tell me your favourite film and then tell me the best film and then maybe like a point of hilarity.
To discuss. My favourite film was The Ornithologist.
Oh, I knew it would
be. Surprise! I liked the gay Catholic forest movie. So it's from a director called João Pedro Rodríguez. Actually, it might be called Rodri something else. I've got a dot, dot, dot there. But it's about Fernando. It's about Fernando. Maybe it is just, you know, maybe this is basically the Orientalism, you know, pleasure. In any case.
We all know it's about Catholics.
It's about kinky Catholicism. I mean, the thing that Madonna knows about Catholicism, this director also knows, that it's ultimately about kink.
Let me tell you, every Catholic knows that about Catholicism. You're looking at it from the outside.
Yes, for some reason I needed a canoe to be overturned. And for two Chinese tourists on the Santiago path who have lost their way in the Portuguese forest to show me that tying up somebody in the style of St. Sebastian could have different meanings in different contexts.
Oh, whatever could they be?
Anyway, this film was so immersive. You know, it was really a jungle book.
What was the crowd like?
The crowd mainly was gay. The crowd was gay. And that reminds me of another film at MIFF where the crowd was gay and they had to move the film to a bigger cinema, which was Beach Rats.
Which apparently was terrible.
It was. Oh, I'm so glad you've heard it was terrible. Yeah. I thought I just needed to spread the word on that one.
I don't know. I dodged a bullet with that.
Oh, God.
It was going to be my last film as well.
I was so angry.
Yeah, okay.
I'm generally bored by bad critiques and everyone at MIFF like wants to give a 2.5-star David versus Margaret sort of thing. And it's like, no one cares. No one cares what you hate. But I was angry about Beach Rats because it created the circumstances for violence against gay men by other gay men.
Oh, so it was really politically problematic.
It was super unnecessary.
Yeah,
you know, it's about a closeted white guy in an urban environment, in a bourgeois family, and it's like, come on, this is not the story now.
Yeah.
And don't make that person somehow a victim but also a perpetrator of hate-fueled violence against queers.
Oh, my God. It sounds like an MRA argument.
It was
like,
essentially right-wing.
Who's really the victim here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, let's notice muscular white bodies, but in a pitying way.
What about me?
Yeah, yeah. I'm just playing down ball by myself in the rain, okay?
I'm the forgotten victim in this.
God, it was sexist as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It was gross.
So, most gay men films.
But I was just angry that every you know, gay white guy in Melbourne was there. It was like, what a waste. What a waste.
Well, you could have just hopped on Grindr and...
and it would have exploded. And just blocked
all of them. No, matched that to their Twitter and see if
the
they liked
day,
the movie or didn't like...
495 kilometres away. Wow, I've lost everyone.
No, match them to their Twitter profile and block anybody who liked the movie.
Okay, next year. MQFF, I'm doing it.
It's a good way
of doing it. No cinephiles.
My turn.
Yes.
So I went and saw, you know, much in my area of interest, I went to the Pioneering Women's Dream. And it was honestly the best thing that's ever happened to me. Every single film I saw at MIFF was a soul-shattering revelation that has changed me profoundly.
Wow.
And it sounds so dramatic, but it's true. But I will give you the two highlights, I think, from that stream, even though every single fucking film in that stream was incredible. And if you can track them down, I'm not sure how easy that is because a lot of them were lost films. Do try. The first one was Gillian Armstrong's film Starstruck. I don't even know why I have never heard of this film. It's the film that she made after my brilliant career. It is a musical set in Sydney in 1982 with a teenage, late teenage girl, maybe in her early 20s. It's honestly like Grease, but like it is as amazing as Grease, but there's no love story. It's just about this girl who wants to become a singer and ends up performing at the Opera House.
Wow.
And apart from it being a cultural document of Sydney that is accurate, it is the Sydney that I grew up in, and I haven't seen that captured before. So I was like hysterically crying at the end of it from mourning. But at the same time, it's just a fucking amazing film.
Mm.
And it's just a cheesy high school musical, essentially.
Oh my God.
And I have no idea why this film is lost, but apparently they're going to re-release it. They're re-releasing the soundtrack, which was written by Neil Finn and a few others of the time. It has an original soundtrack.
Stunning.
Amazing.
Well, can I just pause to say Alexandra Helen Nicholas, who is one of the presenters on 3RRR's Plato's Cave show and podcast, was the curator of this stream that you're describing.
Oh, and excuse me, also my friend Michelle Carey.
What?
Yeah, so Michelle Carey, who is the director.
Well, she runs the whole lot. Yeah.
They co-created it together.
I'm so happy to hear it's been so life-changing.
There was another film in it called Broken Highways, which is a black and white Western from 1993 starring Aidan Young and who was in every film back then, Claudia Carvin. It is the most extraordinary Australian film I've ever seen. And it absolutely changed my perception of what Australian film could be, what it has been. Why this film was buried. It is a surrealist, well, not surrealist, but it is an abstract Lynchian type black and white Western about a sailor who goes out to fucking outback Queensland for the death of his other sailor to tie up some loose ends. I'm just absolutely speechless.
Stunning.
Absolutely speechless about this film. I had no duds.
Did you see any new things?
Because
that might be a bit of a tip / trick.
Well, of course, all of these films were an hour and a half or under, But also with the Pioneering Women stream, most of the films either had the director there.
Great.
So they did an introduction and then a Q&A afterwards. So I got to hear also all of these stories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
These stories about producing these films in Sydney or in Melbourne. Most of the other films were set in Melbourne. I don't think I did actually see a new film.
That's your secret tip.
Yeah, see old films all the time.
See old films at MIFF and see event-type things at MIFF too, because I saw The Songkeepers, this doco about the Central Australian Aboriginal Women's Choir, who were there at the premiere, you know, and they sang.
Yeah.
And it was just so different and so authentic and fascinating to see a film about them and to see their reactions. Yeah. It was just so joyful and so wonderful. But next year, I mean, I always make little mini resolutions. Last year was fewer docos because docos are crap.
Yeah.
Next year it's going to be old stuff and events.
Yeah, and that's why, like, I haven't been to MIFF in a long time because we all know about my thing about film being crap now. But the reason why I went to this was, like, A, what an amazing thing to do. Two, I didn't think that I would be... I know for sure that I would never be able to see these films projected and or in the same time frame. And three, it was the event stuff surrounding it as well. I didn't even think that, like, I could get so much about hearing about these stories, about how they filmed them and their process and stuff like that. It was just very magical and special. And to Alexandra and Michelle, I thank you very much. It was just unbelievable.
On that note, and with perfect timing.
Let's go.
Our second production today is Credentials, a world premiere performance by the still alive David Williamson. My dad knows about this guy. So off I went to La Mama. And the program says David Williamson returns to his La Mama roots with a black comedy in the tradition of his early hits such as The Removalist. Credentials takes a darkly comic look at the widening gulf between those Australians born into security, opportunity and education, and those who have to fight for their life to get any of those things. So it's about Chrissy, loves her job, she's a paramedic, but then her boss, Stephen, discovers that she faked her credentials to become an AMBO, and so faces losing the thing she cares most about, credentials. So the story of the play is actually her story of her life to Stephen as she fights for her right to keep her job because she has authentically learnt what needs to be learnt to be a proper AMBO and to be seen in a different kind of light against the backdrop of her roots. So she's from the country where everyone is bored, where people get pregnant, where people are, you know, behaving violently to each other, and ultimately works her way up in a deeply problematic way. There are drugs, there is sex work, there is Sydney, and here she is wanting to make a better fist of it in this profession. So I was keen to see this partly because I think La Mama is really the real thing. You know, you go there and you get a sense that here's where it's being made. Here's the new writers. Here are the young performers. There's a real sense of occasion and love with the little raffle before the show. You know, that'll just never die. Everybody, you know, survives the raffle because that's what you do at La Mama. And there's always some kind soul overseeing things like a maitre d'. And it's just always a lovely and awkward environment to be in. I enjoyed many aspects of this production, including a character called Jessica, who's a private school girl, who's the real opposite of Chrissy. She's presented as somebody who just has it all, and her mum just keeps supporting her, even though she keeps changing her mind about what she wants to do. She channeled a real sort of thing that I'm familiar with and that I witness in all sorts of contexts in a way that I actually found quite comic. No one was laughing, but I thought it was funny.
A little too close to home for
Yeah, a little bit. But the story was told in a sequential way. There was a sense of growing identification with this character, Chrissy, and just by living through the experiences she goes through. I think Williamson does make his rhetorical point, which is that there are different ways to be qualified for things. And it's a bit simplistic to suggest that only those people who can access these institutions that keep people out should be able to get ahead in our culture. So that registered and settled with me as a message.
Okay.
And yeah, that's what I've got.
That's all you've got to say. I think this is the tale of two sex workers because Chrissy's boss, as she's unfolding the tragedy of her life and how she, you know, basically had to lie to get herself out of the circumstances that she had found herself in. The parallel story that is told of her boss's child, who is a privileged child, who basically ends up in the same situation, which is in reverse. So privilege down to sex work and then bad situation up to sex work. I feel like that was the political intention of the show. I mean, like, there's other things, but let's just focus on that for now. It's interesting because these are pretty lofty concepts. I found it very ham-fisted, very middle class, very white. You know, everyone's the same or anyone can end up in the same situation and who's a better person and who's a badder person. And, you know, do you think the privileged sex worker is as a badder person as the street working, walking sex worker? She's lazy, but the paramedic, she wants to work, so is she better? There was all these kind of, I think, very ham-fisted and kind of offensive thought experiments in there and presenting the data in the way that they did. And it was quite literal back and forth. Like the it'd be like, this is my story. Oh, now here's my parallel story about my child. And now here's my story. You know, But having said all that, even though I did find this pretty offensive and quite stupid, it sucked me in. He really has a way with unfolding a story. And I was shitty watching most of this play, but I was captivated.
And you think it's the writing.
And I find that really amazing. So although he is like obviously politically worlds apart from where I come from and quite patronizing about the subject matter that he was trying to educate other wealthy white people on, I was there.
Yeah, and that's not impossible that the material would be problematic, but the way that it's presented and the format works. I wonder too, with a playwright like Williamson, I'm sure that we've seen so many post-Williamson type stories in Australian theatres that we're sort of satisfied by it, partly because it's him returning to his roots, as the program says. You know, this is something that we know how to read, we know how to receive and decode. There were some elements of the production that I thought really didn't work. I mean, the actors staying on the stage all the time, but just in a kind of passive
mode. Yeah, that didn't
You don't
work
have
for me
to
either.
Be postmodern. You know, you can actually leave a stage. That's okay. That didn't quite work. There were also some threads to the story that were skipped over pretty quickly. And maybe that's a feature of telling these stories that's necessary, these sort of gaps and cracks in the narrative. I mean, it turns out that Chrissy's father is essentially, you know, a pedophile or has sort of really deeply problematic desires for his own daughter that sort of get neatly hugged out at a certain point of the narrative. So to sort of just push your lawnmower past that sort of stuff seems a bit awkward.
Yeah, and that the rich daughter sex worker marries a John and everyone's okay with it. You know, like really okay with it. Not and, just sort of like a few knitted brows. It's just the fact that he's wealthy and really into her and they're all like, yeah, that's fucking great. You know, like there was a lot of... You know, I do feel like that his heart was in the right place with wanting to tell this story, but you don't know what you don't know, and his privilege really fucking shines through with how this story has been delivered and the assumptions that has been made about these people that he has clearly had very little contact with.
So you think it can work as propaganda for telling your own story, telling what you know?
I don't understand what you mean by that.
So you think that this is an example of a play where it's like, dude, if you're going to tell a story that you actually have experience of and data about.
Well, I think if you're moving into quite sort of very emotionally charged or politically charged territory, I think it's a risk.
Yeah.
And I think you risk coming off as a paternalistic asshole.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the same time, and maybe as a symptom of that, you can come across as trite. You know, things don't ring true. There were some lines that I noted down as, you know, not quite being realistic, and they had more of a sort of Home and Away Neighbours quality than a real everyday cinema verite type speech quality to them. So characters will say things like, that just became part of life, and either you do this or I'm dead. You know, it's which you don't have to say too calmly for them to be drag, you know. And maybe that's a feature of not quite knowing how sex workers actually talked in the 90s and trying to get it.
I think you saying the word neighbours is very, very, very apt for this. Mm-hmm. It's like almost after school special type sort of field. No,
I agree.
In all honesty. But I think it's sort of overarching message of who has access to what education and the cycle of poverty. That was very spot on. And I think that was the overarching message, but it got lost in the, you know, perhaps overly dramatic way that he told it. I think some of the elements could have been really turned down for the message to have been more easily received.
I think you're right.
But at the same time, I'm not the audience for this message, so who knows who got out of this, you know, what was intended.
Next time I'll send my dad along.
But, you know, thank you for picking this because it was very interesting. I wouldn't say that I enjoyed it, but I thought it was very good. Yeah.
Marvellous.
Yeah.
Coming soon. What is coming? What is coming soon? Melbourne Festival is coming.
Oh, good. I'm glad you want to talk about
Have
it.
Have we flicked? Have we booked?
Yeah. I mean, I love Taylor Mack. I mean, there's a whole controversy around...
Got $799, love?
$700. I mean, you know...
$699. You're right.
Yeah, it's $700. Yeah, I'm all over it. You know...
Are you going?
Look, potentially I am someone with the means to pay for that, but it just kind of... blows out my budget for everything else.
Who is Taylor Mack?
Oh, he's fabulous.
Okay.
He's absolutely fabulous.
Uh-huh.
Singer, performer. I saw him a few years ago do a show about Tiny Tim.
Mm-hmm.
He was also the Hedwig after John Cameron Mitchell. So okay. He replaced John Cameron Mitchell on Broadway.
Right.
His voice is extraordinary and he will be the closest you will ever get to experiencing David Bowie.
Mm.
Like his singing is extraordinary. I'm going to go to the closing party.
Uh-huh.
And now actually I've cancelled a trip, so I'll go to the opening party as well. Oh, that's awesome. I didn't realise that. But that is a boon to get that performance. I mean, Jane Howard I think is really right. Jane Howard, the theatre critic, that, you know, we do really mangling things in this country by... You know, he's doing it. The original performance is 24 hours of the history of American music. But of course, we're seeing it over four nights, over 6 hours.
So he does it as a durational performance?
Yes.
Oh, that is disappointing.
Yeah.
I would see the 24-hour one.
It's really disappointing.
Oh, I didn't know that the breaking up of it was a thing for just Melbourne.
Yeah.
Oh.
So for people with $700.
Because I thought, as a Wagner fan, I thought that maybe it was modelled on the four big operas of the Ring Cycle. No. But that's just a local. thing.
Darling. Of course you did. So that's a huge boon for the festival, but I'm not really interested in anything else. What about you?
Well, I just thought I'd draw attention to a few little things in the music stream that look good. I know that Peter De Jager will be wonderful. So he plays the piano like nobody. He's a little boy and he plays the crazy stuff. Like if you want to see big unplayable, wild piano.
All right, you've sold it to me, I'll come.
Double Manual is the name of the show. He's playing only Xenakis, who is one of those...
Thank God.
Oh, I know, right? One of those composers of the 20th century that just sounds like... So if you're into that, he is the person to play it for you. And I saw him recently doing something impossible, so that's going to be amazing. In fact, maybe I'll stop there, because the rest sort of sells itself, but... The Peter De Jager piano show just has him sort of staring autistically at the camera. So there's nothing pitching it except the fact that Melburnians who are into this stuff know that he's the guy, right? So
okay.
So if you're into that, check that out.
All right.
Cool.
Are you doing anything else?
At Melbourne Festival? I'm seeing that thing about old people talking about sex.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I feel like if you made a show, that would be that show.
And I'm going... I'm not old enough yet, but I'll be in it one day. And I'm also seeing the Wayne McGregor Paris Opera Ballet Tree of Codes.
I know.
Tree of Codes.
I'm going to that as well, but I don't know. All of these things, again, three wrongs or three rights probably make a wrong. I don't know. But I'm definitely going to give it a whirl.
And I'm pleased that there was a little bit of talk about cost when the $700 ticket was announced. You know, that people are thinking, what's it worth? How much does it have to cost? Can we do it more cheaply? That Peter De Jager piano show is just almost infinitely more affordable than some of these bigger things and might be just as memorable.
But critically, the Taylor Mack show conversation, apart from it being split up, is that, and of course there's 100 performers that perform as a part of it. Like, it's an expensive show, don't get me wrong. But, you know, Melbourne International Arts Festival presumably is for Melburnians and they get a fuckload of funding to put on that festival for Melburnians. If you're going to bring a really super queer performer out for your festival, you better make sure that it's financially accessible to queer people.
Mm.
$700 is not financially accessible to anyone except very wealthy boomers.
Yeah.
So that's honestly, that is disgraceful. And
it will change the event.
It will change the event. It will change who will see the event. It will change who will get what out of the event.
Mm.
And although I'm sure it will like flip the wigs of quite a few 50-year-old, 60-year-old people, there's going to be a whole bunch of people who walk out of it. you know, I'd like to know how those ticket sales are going, because who the fuck wants to see that who has $700?
Not my dad.
So it's been, I think it's very tone deaf all the way.
Okay, on that note, that is it for this month. Thank you so much for listening. You can contact Carla and me at us@acrossisle.com, on our Facebook page, Across Isle, or at our Twitter account, @AcrossIsle. Thank you, Shaq West. Thank you, Mark Barrage, for our sound and music. Thank you to all of the artists whose work we saw, heard, and admired this month. We love and respect you very much. Without you, we'd have to do our own nightclub dancing.
Oh, we're going to. Remember, Fringe is coming up.
Improvise. See you next month.
Bye.